Hi, it's Guy Raz here with the TED Radio Hour. If you heard our show last week on storytelling, you might remember our segment with Andrew Stanton.
Am I on the phone here?
Hello?
Hey, Andrew, it's Guy Raz here.
Hi, Guy, how are you?
Who has one of the best storytelling brains in the business. So I'm just like, can I, like, test you for a sec?
Sure.
I say, Lawrence, you are a clown.
I don't want to be part of your big push.
Yeah. Andrew's written some of the most iconic animated films of the last 20 years. Toy Story, WALL-E, Finding Nemo, Monsters, Inc. And we chatted for about 45 minutes, but we left out a lot of good stuff. So we figured, you know, if you're a writer or an editor or you just do any kind of creative work or if you just want to tell better stories at parties, take a listen to some of what we left out. Andrew talks about what makes for a good story, why some people tell bad ones, and a lot about his favorite movie, Lawrence of Arabia. So here's Andrew.
I am now considered one of the old timers at Pixar. I've been a writer and animator and director and story man all at different times here at Pixar for the last 23 years.
Wow, so you're considered like an old guy there.
Yeah.
And you're not even 50 yet, right?
No.
You're like far from it.
but in tech terms...
you're like an old man.
In startup terms, I'm an old man.
Wow. Yeah. You're on, like, Medicare in startup terms.
I know. It's a little depressing. They keep hiring and they keep coming in younger, as far as and it's annoying.
Yeah. What was a first story that grabbed you, that you remembered?
You mean in my life?
Yeah.
A first story that grabbed me? Wow. That's a good question.
Do you want me to tell you the first story that grabbed me?
Sure.
It was, I just forgot the title. It was Mike Mulligan. Mike Mulligan.
Oh, the steam shovel.
Yeah, the steam shovel.
Yeah, I think it's called Mike Mulligan.
Mike Mulligan, yeah.
But I got to tell you, the story that stuck with me to the point that I have had to pass it on is, and maybe it's a little standard, is Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. I still to this day vow it is the best book to ever read aloud to a child.
Yeah, I mean, it has all those things that a child like, right? Because, mm-hmm. I mean, it has obviously candy. Mm-hmm. And then, like, winning that golden ticket.
Yeah, and the accuracy of types of children that everybody they can relate to, and sort of how blatant they are in those roles, and the way he cliffhangs things on each chapter. The only thing that comes in really close behind that is Jules Pfeiffer has this fantastic book called The Man in the Ceiling that I always recommend people to read to their kids.
Do you think that you're a natural storyteller?
I think I would say yeah. I think I can't remember a time where I wasn't either telling a story or trying to mimic telling a story that I thought was so well told, whether I saw that on TV or heard it on the radio or heard a friend tell it and try to retell it. I think that that's just always been... I'm the oldest of my siblings, and I can't remember a time that I wasn't trying to entertain them and keep them hanging, or even having to be a babysitter and tell them stories.
That's interesting. I mean, it's just interesting because I've interviewed hundreds of artists and creative people, and it's really unusual when they understand or they really sort of examine what they do critically.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, if you have to do it more than once, because I think everybody's got a great story in them, and everybody has that one thing that they can tell really well. It's almost like they say everybody has one good novel in them. But to have to repeat it, you can't rely on luck anymore like you might have on the first go-around. And so I wanted so badly to not have it be a one-time opportunity after we did Toy Story. I really lucked into that opportunity to do that movie, and I wanted to keep doing that for as long as I could. So I kind of put myself through school again, and I read every script that I could find. I wanted to know. I specifically looked for scripts that were the reader's script, is what they call it in Hollywood, the script that got the green light, because it'll get rewritten and changed and turned into a shooting script later. I wanted to read the thing that got an executive or an agent excited and said, we should make this, and see why. And so I literally have a library of about 150 scripts, and I just kind of put myself through school, read every book about how to do stuff, it really opened my eyes to stuff, but I've also come to understand that there's a time and a place for it. And they call it analysis paralysis, where you can understand what you're doing to the point of stagnation and the sort of holding yourself up. And so you try to go on intuition for a long time and just have the guts to be silly and take risks and not do anything without judgment. And then take a step back and assess what you've done. And that's when you use all that knowledge that you've gained from what makes that stuff work.
You've got that quote, drama's anticipation mingled with uncertainty.
Which I love.
Yeah.
That epitomizes it. And you know, I'm not that smart. And it takes for something that simple and profound to really lodge in my brain and for me to follow it. And to me, it's a great filter. It's a great or litmus test to use. It's like, have I made you want to know what happens next? And it works down on almost a cellular level. I mean, am I dying to know what is going to come out of somebody's mouth next? You know, not just what's going to happen next in the plot. And you realize how all of it's a very carefully orchestrated design.
When you think about, I mean, not just the stories that you write, but your own story, because, I mean, I guess that's really sort of the essence of storytelling is our own stories. How do you know what to leave in and what stays out?
I think that you don't, and I fall into the trap as a writer trying to second guess that too early on the writing process. I think there comes a point where your writing is really editing. And I actually think the roles of what people consider, or in my world, it's a film editor and a writer, are almost the same role. I heard Tom McCarthy, who's a writer-director, actor, say this once. He said that he would highly recommend that anybody who wants to write should actually edit a movie for a while if they want to become a screenwriter, because they'd really, really start to understand the power of economy, of shorthand, of juxtaposition, of being able to jump from one thing to another, and it's the select absence of information and controlling that really is the power behind it. And once you kind of know you have all the proper information that you're trying to convey when you're writing, that's where you start to use all those skills. It's like, okay, when do I need to tell you this, or do I even need to tell it to you at all? And that's, to me, the fun part. The really pain in the ass part is not knowing ahead of time what all the pieces are that you need. And you almost have to generate way too much material in order to know what the right pieces are. And that's the hard part. There's just really no way around a tremendous amount of labor to ultimately come down to a very small final product.
It's interesting because you talk a lot about what stories should have, but then you say, at the end of your talk, you say, you know, storytelling is about guidelines and it's not about rules, because I guess there are always exceptions.
Yes, exactly. And you don't want to be, I think if I have any consistent fear, it's that I'm unconsciously closing doors to ideas. And I was raised also musically, like I played a lot of musical instruments, and I always find music as a perfect analogy that you wouldn't expect anybody to say, I'm going to write a song, and just sit down and it's just going to come straight out of their fingers onto the keys or onto the strings, and that's it, it's done. Nobody would think anything, in matter of fact, they would have expectations that you are going to just fiddle and play and jam a lot on your instrument until you kind of find a couple chords that sound interesting, a few melodic lines, and that you may piece them all together and find that, like, really some of these were meant for one song and another for, and then you just keep playing, and then maybe months might go by till you find the right bridge for the chorus. Well, that's exactly what writing is for a story. And you have to be able to have the freedom and the courage to jam, whether that's in private or with other people, and just play a lot of bad music to find that stuff. And that's when you start applying the rules or the guidelines to help sort of road test what you have.
What are those guidelines? I mean, what does a story have to do?
Well, the biggest thing it has to do, and I say this in the talk, is it's got to make me care, and it's got to continue to make me care. And it doesn't always mean like I actually care about the cause that the character's behind. It's like, do I even care to pay attention? Then the trick's all over the map, and it doesn't surprise me that one rule might have worked for one story as far as a storytelling guideline, and that it was contradictory and didn't help at all in another story. I've been in too many of them now, either that I've directly or indirectly been involved in, to see so many different ways to get to the answer. But the end result is always the same, that I got completely invested in the piece.
You know, I was thinking about what you were saying, and you're talking, I mean, the thing is that a lot of people hear good stories, right? But yeah. not a lot of people can tell them, know how to tell them.
Well, I've come to, you know, I say this a lot at work. I'm like, it's one thing to have a good story, but you can completely be a bad storyteller and hide the fact that you're sitting on a good story. I mean, we all know people that can tell jokes really poorly and just screw it up. And you cannot recognize that that joke was ever funny. And I feel storytelling is exactly the same. And that's why I loved opening the thing with a joke, because when you go back and analyze it, every single thing I say and do and thing that I take time on or rush through, any choice I've made in the telling of that joke was all in service to that one punchline at the end. And if you know where you're headed, that's what gives you the courage and the joy in knowing where you can take long pauses or just how to choreograph yourself all the way to that point.
Tell me about the unifying theory of 2+2.
You know, I think that you see it really expounded upon in WALL-E.
And this is a real theory that you like gave a title to.
Well, we kind of jokingly called it that just because my co-writer on Nemo, Bob Peterson, was also an engineer, and he, sometimes we talk this sort of pseudoscience speak to each other. And
sounds very, very official.
Yeah, it made us sound way more important. I bet you the theory falls apart once it's really broken down. But what I loved about it was that I hate it when I can tell that a storyteller or a filmmaker is second-guessing where they think I'm at watching a movie. And, you know, I always give the example of, like, suddenly the strings are swelling at a moment that I'm supposed to be affected. A tear is supposed to roll down my cheek, and they haven't actually earned it in the actual function of the story itself. And that actually pulls me out. It makes me mad. And in other words, the strings are showing. It's like all storytelling in a weird way is manipulation, but you just don't want anybody to know that nobody wants to think that they were being manipulated.
Of course
nobody
not.
Wants to feel like they're stupid,
right?
Or a lemming.
Right.
And to me, when you really get into that, it's the best safeguard against that is never giving anybody the actual information. It's what they call exposition. People say, you know, it's one thing to have a character say, "Boy, I'm really hungry. I'd like a sandwich," as opposed to seeing them in a scene and they're trying to pay attention to a class, like to a teacher telling you something, but their eyes keep looking at this sandwich that's being eaten by somebody, you know, two tables over, and they just keep getting distracted. I've decided watching that person's hungry and would rather be eating, and that's involved my participation as the viewer, and that is giving the audience the highest regard and treating them with the utmost respect, and so that's to me what 2+2 kind of represents, is respect for the audience.
A story has to have a promise, a promise to do what?
Well, that was. To be honest, that was something that I kind of always intuitively knew but never had put words to, and it was Phil Rosenthal, who was the creator of Everybody Loves Raymond, was explaining that to me once, how you start off a good either joke or a good story with a promise, and it sets up expectations. It's saying, you know, this is how we think it's going to, this is where we want you to think something's going to go towards, or what do you think is going to happen. In other words, I'm trying to give a good example. It'd be like in Toy Story, and Woody's telling everybody at the beginning, all the toys in the room, that we all need to get a moving buddy, and that everything has to, we can't have anything go wrong. I want to make sure everything goes safely for Andy. And in a weird way, that promise that that's what we're trying to do is, in a weird way, a promise that it won't go that way. And it sort of sets up your expectations. And that's part of the anticipation mingled with uncertainty. It's sort of setting you up with this sense of like, I know everybody needs it to go right, so therefore something's gonna have to go wrong. And I'm dying now to wait and see if my instincts, if my gut instincts are correct.
What was the promise in Lawrence of Arabia?
That's a good question. I don't know if I've ever looked at it that way. I think it was the promise, I'll bet you, was we're going to explain, because it's all about it starts with his death, and then it goes to his funeral, his memorial, and everybody's trying to say they either knew him or with this reporter running around trying to ask all these people, did you know him? What was he like? And I think what the promise you think is that we're going to go through this story and we're going to figure out who he was. And you're going to go through it hoping to see, like, okay, are any of these people correct? Or are any of what I've heard about him historically are correct? And if you notice, the last shot of him at the end of that movie, see, I really know this movie, is he's behind a windshield being driven home, and it's so dirty that his face has no features. And you end up finding that he never figured out who he was, and neither could anybody else.
It is an amazing story.
Yeah, I get something out of it every time.
when people absorb one of your stories, like see one of your films, what do you want them to feel when they leave?
Oh, it's always the same thing. I just want them to be transported. I just want them to feel like they that they enjoyed where they were, that they felt some feelings and particularly. That they felt the sense of wonder that all my favorite movies did for me. At a very young age, it's very common for a lot of us, anybody to say it was a classic Walt Disney movie. But as we got older, at least in my generation, Spielberg took that mantle with a lot of his movies. But there's, some very dark art house movies as you get more mature that are incredibly life-affirming. And I feel like that sense of wonder slash life affirmant is such a drug, and I don't know how to get it any other way. Maybe some really great pieces of music do it every once in a while, but it's just something that that's the greatest compliment. If I can make anybody feel like that for a moment, let alone a whole film, then I can't think of a greater gift.
Andrew, I know you've got to get back to work and making the movies that we all want to go see. So I'm going to end it here, unless there's something you wanted to add or
No, it was an absolute pleasure. It was fun to talk about this. I don't get to talk about it this often. I think we all take it for granted here at Pixar. We work so hard on making every single story as special as it can be.
And then I guess when the films come out, you sort of do the 5-minute junkets about the film.
And it's more of an encapsulation. But as you could tell from the talk and from this, I love drilling down.
It's Andrew Stanton. He was part of our episode Framing the Story. You can hear the entire show at ted.npr.org or download it right here on iTunes. I'm Guy Raz. We'll have another new episode of the TED Radio Hour later this month. Thanks for listening. Girls in white in a perfume night with the lights as bright as the stars.